reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man.
This is Tribute Racing. Joined with me is Mark Farmer, also Tribute Racing, and Adam Tate, also Tribute Racing. We got the trio triplets of Tribute on here, and it's a fun day. I mean, we get a chance to bring you guys the 99th running, the Indianapolis 500 preview show, and we're right here live in Indy overlooking the front stretch, and it is absolutely gorgeous. And Josh, it's been an eventful qualifying session. Month. We've had airborne. We've had a ton of other things go on, and we're looking forward to bringing you all of that stuff on this latest edition. And Adam, how are you feeling today?
What was that, Joey?
So how are you feeling today?
I'm feeling wonderful. I wish I was up there with you guys in Indianapolis.
Well, without further ado, we're going to get into this preview show here. And first and foremost, I want to give you the rundown of the starting lineup. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the changes that made late that you may not have heard about, as well as some predictions for tomorrow. So, Josh, why don't you go ahead and take us into row one and the pole sitter.
All right. Row one has 2008 Indy 500 champion Scott Dixon. In the middle of row two has Will Power, and running out the front row has Power's teammate and non-rival from last year, Simon Pagenaud.
And then right there in row two, we've got Tony Kanaan on the inside. We've got Elio Castro Neves in the middle, and we've got Justin Wilson leading the Honda Brigade and the Autosport car on the outside in six.
In a Rolling Stone sponsored car, and it looks amazing.
And in row three, we've got Sebastian Bourdais, and we've got Marco Andretti making up the middle, the second Honda, and we've got Joseph Newgarden rounding out the outside of that baby. And that's essentially going to be our top nine, with J.R. Hildebrand cracking out the top ten. And, let me see here. Of those top ten, I mean, obviously right now, Scott Dixon and Will Power have got to be the favorites. But the highest Honda in this top 10 is Justin Wilson. Do you expect a little double come race day?
You know, I really like Justin Wilson. I've always said he's an underrated talent. He's actually the only driver in the world that has driven the current generation Indy cars. He's also driven in Formula One. He drove the old kart series, and he drove the final iteration champ cars as well. So, you're talking about a guy with a lot of open-wheel experience. It is Justin Wilson, and to go out and to be the top Honda on pole day, I thought was awesome. I think he could be a contender. He's more of a road course guy, but he's really upped his oval game. Same kind of thing with Sebastian Bourdais. I was really impressed by the qualifying effort Bourdais put on. And even though he's not in the top nine, as you were saying there, in 10th is J.R. Hildebrand. And for a guy who almost won it in 2011, we all know when he, just kind of overcooked it going into four and got up in the marbles and into the wall and gave Dan Weldon that beautiful victory. Hildebrand hasn't been in a car in quite a long time. And to come in and jump in that thing and take it up to 10th really, really impressed me.
No, absolutely. I completely agree. And, for the life of me, I don't know what to make about the Chevy versus Honda thing, and we'll touch on that little thing. That's definitely been the hot topic of, the entire time I've been up here since, I got up here Tuesday. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a hot topic here for a good portion of the week. We've got, starting in 11th position, we've got Carlos Munoz, another Andretti Autosport driver. Ed Carpenter is going to make up the 11th position, and that's going to complete row four. Row five is Oriol Servia, Charlie Kimball, and 2000 winner Juan Pablo Montoya. This is 15th year anniversary of that win, where he led 167 laps in ridiculously dominating fashion. And, you know, I mean, he just seemed about as calm as ever on media day as far as, you know, how do you feel about this 500? Oh, I felt like I could do the first 500. That was wonderful. You know, it was okay. And
that wasn't bad.
You got Ryan Hunter Ray in row six, last year's winner, and Graham Rahal, who's been on a tear with a couple of good runs, making up the middle of row six, and Simona DiSilvestro is going to clean out the outside of that row. Row seven, starting on the inside, we got James Jakes, then Alex Tagliani, Sage Karam, and that's going to complete row seven.
All right, row eight has Connor Daly in the third Schmidt-Peterson most century, fueled by Bacon Smith Field Special. The middle row has Townsend Bell, who always runs good here, and rounding out the outside of row eight is Takuma Sato, who nearly won it in 2012. And row nine has Pippa Mann, the third woman in the race, and Dale Coyne, the third entry. The middle of the row has Gabby Chavez, who was in the top 10 in Carb Day, looked really well there. Then on the outside is Sebastian Saavedra, making his first start at the Brick Arbor Chip Ganassi Racing. And row 10 actually has the three slowest cars in the field that had to go out and requalify for the shootout. It has Jack Hawksworth in the 4180 Supply Honda Dallara. The middle has rookie Stefano Coletti making first oval start. And on the outside is a surprisingly slow effort by USAC standout Brian Clausen, which Brian won the pole for the Freedom 100 in 2011. But in his KV SH Jonathan Bird's entry, they've just been way off the pace. I mean, essentially, you know, Jonathan Bird's their names on the car, but I mean it's the third KV car, so not really sure why they're slow. But
and essentially, you know, Clausen bumped out 1996 Indianapolis 500 winner Buddy Lazier, who was trying to go for I don't even know his umpteenth attempt now. I mean, he's been to this. That was the most compelling story on pole day, bump day, qualifying day, because Lord knows the shenanigans that existed to lead up to qualifying day led to something different that we hadn't seen. We expected a fast nine and then a bump day and this and that, and it all kind of got gelled and combined into one, and we saw a little bit of the old qualifying with a little bit of the new, and, you know, for all intents and purposes, it was a little bit of a cluster. Now, the reason why Mr. Farmer here decided to tell you about the slowest cars being in row 10 is because there are three other cars with compelling storylines of their own. And bear with us, because this could be a little confusing, and we're going to try to deliver it as simple as possible. You got Ryan Briscoe on the inside of row 11, Tristan Vautier on the middle of row 11, and you got James Davison on the outside. Now, Ryan Briscoe is driving James Hinchcliffe's car. James Hinchcliffe suffered a really rough crash and sustained a leg injury, and he saddled up in the hospital, and he hit, I believe it was turn three. We saw, mm-hmm. We were doing the pace car ride, and we saw some of the marks over there in turn three. And so they ended up getting Chevrolet factory driver from essentially sports car racing over there, and he won Daytona and Sebring earlier this year. He's going to look to continue his phenomenal run, and I mean, he's super sub. I mean, if you couldn't, outside of maybe getting Buddy Lazier or somebody else that may have been at the track, I love the addition of Ryan Briscoe. And the other complication is all three of these are interesting complications here. Tristan Vautier, he is in a car that Carlos Suertes was supposed to be driving. Carlos Suertes, according to IndyCar reports, sustained a inner ear condition the day, card day, so yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to go with Tristan Vautier in that car. And James Davison, who's starting on the outside, the final spot, didn't qualify the car. Tristan Vautier did. And so essentially you got Davison, who's starting behind Vautier, because all this falls back on owner points when you've got three different drivers who don't have any IndyCar points to put outside of Davison, but that car is last in their points. So hopefully that was as simple as possible. With that being said, Adam, we've done the full run here. What do you take away from what you expect as far as in maybe these bottom three, who do you have a good day or maybe a surprise run as we get ready to pick some favorites here later?
Well, man, it's the bottom three. This is the weirdest back row I've ever seen in, you know, nearly a quarter century of watching the Indy 500. So I don't know what to expect out of Vautier and Davidson. I hope they both have strong races. I actually like both of them quite a lot. Ryan Briscoe, this is a guy who set pole at this track before. And a lot is made about setting pole position, but if you look the past couple years, Ryan Hunter Ray last year, I think he started like 13th. So you don't have to start in front in Indy to win the race. It's a long race, 500 miles, and Ryan Briscoe has a shot, you know? And I love what Josh pointed out the other day, that Ryan Briscoe has a chance to make history this year. It's a long shot, but he won the 24 Hours of Daytona. He won the 12 Hours of Sebring. He's driving here at Indianapolis for the 500, and later next month he's driving at Le Mans. And the only person who's ever won all four, as Josh pointed out, was A.J. Foyt. So to win all four in one year would be huge for Briscoe. I like what you were saying, how he's a super sub. And he's really a guy who should have a full-time ride in the series anyway. So I love that they drafted him in to be in Hinch's car. And, you know, for Hinch's sake, who is up and walking again today, I know we'll talk more on that later, I'd love to see Ryan have a good run.
Absolutely. I think there's a gentleman in there with a chime in. Ms. Frank Tarowski, drafting the circus, is you're in Indianapolis. You're not here at the track. We saw you a little bit earlier today. I know you were listening in on a little rundown we got going on here. First of all, how are you doing today? And, you know, what are you up to?
Oh, man, you know what? I'm down here up at Dakota Plaza where they're having the party, man. I've spent the last couple hours down on Gasoline Alley talking to some folks, spent a little time with Sarah Fisher. I got a ride around the track from Gail, who's the lead driver for the Monster Safety Team. That was definitely a fun experience there. But I'll tell you one thing I noticed that I think should really scare the other drivers is Juan Pablo Montoya is so eerily calm and confident. I think other people should be worried. You know, just talking to Juan a couple hours ago, earlier this morning, I'm like, this guy is like not worried about a thing. So I'm still behind Power for the win, but Montoya, I think he's got the he's not worried about a thing going in here. I think other drivers should be very afraid.
Yeah, no disagreement here. I mean, I said from the beginning that Juan Pablo, you know, if I would put down money right now, Juan Pablo has as good a shot as any. I mean, last year he made his, you know, he was able to stretch his fuel mileage longer than anybody else, and he would have had the race won had it not been for a speeding penalty, which ironically. Took him out of the win at the Brickyard 400 in 2009. I want to get into conspiracy theories there. I won't go there. But there's quite a few people to keep their eyes on, or to keep their eyes on, say. I'm not right at the front. I think Dixon and Power are going to be the stars of the show. I definitely do like Justin Wilson. I mean, Wilson was the perfect spot to take a win in 2013 when we restarted with three to go and TK went three wide with Marco and Ryan Hunter-Reay and took the lead for one. Wilson was lurking in the weeds in fifth place. Had the race gone green, seeing drought guys going at each other easily, not buying draft or win. And someone else that I want to touch on, which if people have followed my work, I actually, I have never seen Fiona as calm, cool, and collected before race. I mean, she told me, you know, I've never been this more comfortable on an oval. I mean, I wouldn't expect her to win, but I wouldn't bet against earning a top 10. But I mean, ultimately, all that with Wilson is that it's going to come down to how well the Honda Aero moves, because I mean, that's Honda has said from the beginning, we designed our car to win the 500.
No, absolutely, and I think, you know, look at this field, and first and foremost, stories like Ryan Briscoe are essentially, I mean, that's what makes this race, and guys like him, they come in here, and they're late starters, and then all of a sudden, they put in this hellaciously badass run,
mm-hmm.
and next thing you know, they're battling among the top five, they're the feel-good story, they're what make this race really compelling and dramatic. And along with that, you know, you got someone in there, you know, who would have thought Takuma Sato would have been battling Dario Franchitti in what was one of the classic finishes, whether it was successful or not. People remember that dive in the turn one,
mm-hmm.
in 2012. You know, people remember J.R. Hildebrand. I mean, this race is full of so many compelling memories in its incredible history. And, you know, I believe it was you, Farmer, that was telling me that nobody has won from the back row?
Nope. Well, Mario, 1981, Mario Andretti was given the win after a gap of the race, but the win was rescinded 6 months later. But nobody has won from the back row. The lowest starting spot for a winner was the 1932. The driver's name escapes me right now, but he started in 27th or 28th, I believe. So, to answer your question, nobody won from the back.
Fair enough. If there's anybody that could do it, I damn sure think it's going to be Briscoe can pull something, I mean, right out of a hat, what have you. I mean, Shankar, he got a chance to kind of go out, was around the turbulent air in pack racing, so to speak, on carb day, on Fast Friday. And, you know, another guy to look at, and I'm pretty high on this guy since I talked to him on Media Day because I just touched on him a little bit in 2012. But Takuma Sato seems awfully relaxed. And I know we had Larry Boyd with us on the race car ride, and you know, he seemed very positive with I guess how relaxed Takuma was or Taku. And he talked about how his car didn't feel any different to Gennady or Penske in terms of air. He was just as fast, and he didn't think anybody can really run off and escape anybody else. I tell you what, that guy's quick, and he's going to be quick. He knows his way around this place. And besides him, Ryan Hunter raised in trouble. You know, carb day, it was mentioned that guy couldn't grip to save his life at this point with where grip was on the track. I mean, conditions were different. I mean, you're looking at a couple of days here. It's been really cloudy, cool, overcast, and then all of a sudden on Friday, it's nice, bright, sunny, warm. And, you know, typical of Indianapolis when you're leading into the Indy 500 weekend. And, you know, I don't really think he's got a shot at repeating here. But I tell you what, I like, you know, Frank touched on Juan Pablo Montoya. Guys, the guy's got the mindset for this racetrack. The guy's got a mindset of a champion. He doesn't really look at anything too big or too small. A race is a race is a race. You know, he respects the history of the sport. He understands the history. He understands the magnitude of the situation, but he doesn't sit there and consume himself in his face. And I think that's something to be recognized. And, you know, surprisingly enough, I think row three is a very interesting row. I mean, you got Sebastian Bourdais. Feels good about equipment. Feels great about his equipment. So this is arguably the best car he's got here that he's ever brought here. You got Marco Andretti, who, in qualifying, they tried the Justin Wilson gearing setup where it was 4-5-6. He was the second last car to go out and qualify. That guy's got a stout piece. And at Indy, him, he's third here, he's fourth here. He's got already a massive amount of podiums. I think I'm putting him already to that. And I mean, hopefully he'll find his way among the top five. And to be quick. I don't know how quick, but the speed is not with Ed Carpenter at this track right now. I think it's Joseph Newgarden. I don't think Justin Wilson, I hate it for you guys, y'all are big Justin Wilson guys. Not a big thing for Justin Wilson. I very easily could see him going to Mexico and taking over Hinch's ride at the Isle, because I know he's scrapping it out trying to find a full-time ride and be on for the season. But what we had talked about a couple weeks ago, the Scott Dixon Willpower Show may finally happen. They qualified 1-2. They're 1-2 in card day. They can't really escape each other. They've never really fought each other. And damn it, it's about time we saw. And why not here on the biggest stage, the best track, the best history? Why not here? 2.5-mile oval here at Speedway Indiana. Why the hell not?
Yeah, why the hell not? I mean, the series keeps promoting this indie rifles thing, and hasn't really made a whole lot of sense to me. Of, you know, everybody's a rival, nobody's a rival, but I do think, you know, Scott Dixon and Will Power, you know, they could be the show. It's like, you know, you have Will Power, which, for lack of better terms, has kind of been the, I don't want to insult the guy, but, you know, he's been the idiot savant in a way, no disrespect to him, where Dixon is the tactive assassin. So, you know, you have a perfect, you know, the perfect jousting battle there. Adam?
Yes. And I will say, thank heaven, instead of why the hell not, because I am feeling really positive about this. And, you know, it's Frank. Give him some credit. I know he had to bow out, but Frank really pointed out that these are the top few guys that we got to talking about it, and they've never really had to have a showdown on track. It seems if one wins, the other had a bad day or was a non-factor, and they've never really duked it out. And what's interesting to me is if you look at Scott Dixon's old teammate, Dario Franchitti, he and Power duked it out all the time. It was fantastic. I mean, 3 years in a row, Power was runner-up in the championship, and, you know, to Franchitti. So it was a really intense time, and I think it's about time we got that Ganassi-Penske rivalry heated up again.
How do you feel about Elio getting his fourth one this year? I mean, he had a DNF. Josh pointed out to me earlier off air, it's 2006. I mean, that's 10 years when you're racing. I mean, here we are entering 2015. He hasn't had one in the last 10 races, or this will be the 10th race, so in the last 9 races, 9 starts. I'd say he's due for a DNF, a mechanical failure, some sort of pit crew glitch, I don't know, something. I mean, I can't think that this guy is clean this often at the track.
You know, I don't know. Elio's had a really good run in Indy, obviously, and he's had a really good run this season. And going into this year, most of the talk at Penske, when you talk to people, are about Penske. It was rather about Power, and it was about Pagenaud joining them. And I think it should really be focused more on Montoya, who I think, like Frank says, is a huge threat. And really, Montoya is leading the championship, but Elio's not far behind him. I think Elio could still pull out another strong result and, you know, maybe a victory. He's got, heaven knows, he's got the experience, and he's starting in the middle of row two. You know, it's not row one, but you can easily get to the lead from the fifth spot there on the grid.
Definitely, most definitely. You know, we'll get into the picks and the sleeper picks that we're going to have a little bit later. We're just giving you all kind of a rundown and kind of the feel with how the last couple weeks have been, how everybody's been running. I want to get a chance to touch the hot topic, the elephant in the room, and that's the Speedway Aero Kits. Honda had a very nice product here. Honda had been getting their ass kicked on the road courses because Chevy just figured it out a hell of a lot quicker than everybody else. And they had a great car put together. And they come here and it looked like it was a little bit more even playing ground, looked like everything was more level. And we see three Chevys catch air. And once Ed Carpenter got airborne, enough was enough. And they decided, I think it was it the day before qualifying, the day of qualifying?
Day of, morning.
Day of,
morning of.
And he decided to kind of adjust, do a few adjustments on both aero kits. Honda, once again, had never gotten airborne at this time. And they decided to do essentially, in my opinion, kind of screw the team that had it figured out, that put together a good package, built it the way that it was supposed to be built, and it was fast and dynamic. And there was, don't get me wrong, there was a vicious crash with Pippa Mann where she came off the turn and got loose and essentially pulled a J.R. Hildebrand, but managed to go to the inside of the track and caught the inside wall, the pit road wall, and then spun into the outside. And then following up after qualifying, we had the Hinchcliffe crash, which was confirmed to be a suspension failure. And that's unrelated to the aero kit package. So my question, I'll start with you, Adam, is number one, how do you feel about what IndyCar ended up doing? And do you think it was the right decision, given that now we're looking at the highest Honda end up in sixth, and we really could have had a nice dynamic here, from my point of view?
Yeah, it's really the $64,000 question. Ultimately, was it fair to Honda? No. But it was the only safe decision IndyCar had at the time. You know, it's clear that there was something wrong with the Speedway configuration for the Chevrolet kits. Although there are various other reasons that cars go airborne, and it's a phenomenon that's happened at Indianapolis for many years and will continue to happen. I will give you a little bit of credit because you said this could happen. And really, it's not so much of, is it, you know, something we can pin on Chevy? Is, you know, would Honda have finished better? The sad thing is IndyCar kind of shot themselves in the foot by waiting until May to have these things out on the track for all the teams to be testing. The kits were homologated by January 18th, both the Speedway kit and the road course short oval kit. So, you know, I don't know if you need to have another oval race before Indianapolis. I would not mind that. Or just some more testing, because a lot of the issues stem from a lack of testing, a lack of data, a lack of knowledge about these kits. And changes could have been made to prevent what happened on pole day. So I think they just need to take a look back and, you know, just better implement it next time.
I think it's interesting when you look at the Honda versus the Chevy, and you look at the rear end alone. You've got brackets on the Honda. You've got two brackets that extend pretty tall over the rear wing in the middle. I guess they're give or take 3/4 inch apiece in width, and they stand pretty tall. I want to say about 4 inches above the wing and wrap over or bolt down.
Yeah, the swan neck.
And yeah, the swan neck. And I don't know if maybe that plays a part in why Honda, you know, has a little bit maybe more rear stability. And at the end of the day, I understand IndyCar needed to do something in order to help make this contingent or agreeable. From Honda's point of view, they decided to throw out championship points for qualifying, which I don't remember the last time that was done at the last minute. But it was really, I mean, in this argument, to be completely fair, IndyCar, nobody wins. You know, if you decide not to do anything, the Chevrolet manufacturer gets pissed off. If you do what you did, the Honda fans and the Honda manufacturer gets pissed off. So no matter what you do, somebody's going to be upset at you. And at the end of the day, there wasn't enough testing. You know, and there is a rumor going around that, and it hasn't been confirmed, but there is a rumor that what might happen is that we scrap the aero kits to the 2012 aero package for Texas, which is the next oval up on the calendar. That being said, when you hear me say that, and I'd love to get both your takes, Adam, I'll start with you.
Okay.
What do you think about that? Like, do you remember the 2012 race at TMS?
Oh, yeah. This brings up so many things. First, I want to take half a step back and go more on the aero kits. The Swan Neck actually came from prototype racing over in West and LMS and that kind of thing. It was a more efficient way to manage the airflow. And I've been reading up on this a lot recently because I have a lot of thoughts on it, and I knew it would be a hot topic. When they said they were going to introduce the aero kit back in 2012, Chevrolet and Honda got people working on it immediately. So they had been in the planning stages for years before they were developed and actually put on the cars. So there was a lot of thought put into it. And they make up to 25% more downforce. And that's a limit that Dallara put on it, actually, because it would be too much of a stress on the stock Dallara components still retained if they went higher than that level. So I think they just pushed the boundaries a little bit too far into the realm of experimentation, into the realm of really trying to max these cars out instead of taking it more of a step at a time, evolving them throughout the seasons, what they're going to do with the legality boxes. But, you know, I don't mind going back to the 2012 kit. Ironically, I think the 2012 Speedway kit is far more visually pleasing than either of the solutions from Chevy or Honda, sadly. But for TMS, it makes me worry. The old Dallaras had fantastic racing at TMS, some of the closest IndyCar finishes in history, some of the closest finishes in any series on an oval. But the DW12, it never quite got right in that stock Speedway configuration for TMS. You know, it's not a big super speedway like Indy. It's not a little short oval like Iowa or something like that. So they might need to work a little bit at it. I mean, last year's race was fantastic. They almost took too much downforce off, according to the guys, which people like power, that's what they want. And I think that's what the series needs to do in the future anyway. So I'll be really curious to see if they do that. I think they will wait and see how the 500 plays out tomorrow. If there aren't any serious incidents, I think they may very well keep the Super Speedway kit, albeit in this modified format that they use for qualifying. If there are incidents, they'll switch to that 2012 standard bodywork so fast it'll make your head spin.
Yeah, well, actually, I have a possible explanation for why the Chevrolet car is getting airborne. I have to give to Mark Cipollone of AutoRacing1.com, who his day job is he's an engineer, which but on point, if you look at the rear body work of the Chevrolet, and as Mark calls it, he calls them the butt bumpers. But if you look at the rear inside the wheel pods where the wheel wells are, there's a piece of metal with the car number on it, and that piece is angled. If you're looking at it, it's how would I describe it? It's pushed in, and so that when the car gets completely backwards, you know, that ramp just sucks all the air in, and the car takes off like an airplane. And Mark's suggestion was either get rid of the butt bumpers entirely, which I don't disagree with. I think the car would look a lot better without them, and it would take some of the downforce away too. Which would probably please Willpower, as he's always wants lower downforce. And sorry, my terrible Willpower impression. But or change the design of the ramp to where they're on the bottom, and the ramp would be going up, which would actually push the car down. So. I mean, but what's also kind of peculiar to me is that this DW12, when the tendencies went at, especially at Indy, I mean, Carpenter got 90 degrees in the air in 2012 when he stuffed it in the fence, almost in the same spot where he hit on qualifying day, you know, albeit 10 miles an hour lower, but he got pretty high up in the air too. So that begs the question, you know, is this a Dallara problem or is it a Dallara problem or a Chevy problem or a Honda problem? And I just say it's just a mess from top to bottom. That is how I would look at it. I mean, going back to the 2012 Speedway kit, I mean, Justin Wilson said actually a very smart thing about it in the story that comes from Pruitt wrote is that when NASCAR went to the Car of Tomorrow, which, you know, a lot of mixed opinions of that when it started, it took them several years to get the cars where they were actually raceable. Do you agree, Joey?
I could easily see that. I mean, the first win was at Bristol, and I share Kyle Busch's sentiments on it, where he's drunk. I mean, it was a dump truck. It looked like a damn dump truck. I mean, who the hell? It was just horrible. New park better.
Yeah, but back on point is that maybe the oval kit still needs some development. I mean, obviously every track is different. I mean, Indy having the 90-degree corners, the trajectory of someone spins and hits the wall is going to be different than, say, at TMS. I mean, TMS, you've got the banking to slow the car down a little bit if it slides up. And then and then Fontana's got wider corners, which could potentially be dangerous. I mean, look what happened to Kyle Larson at Fontana. You know, he spun up the track, and the car just caught a lot of momentum before Charlie Kimball nailed him, and the car took off and flew into the catch fence. And then Pocono is kind of similar to Indy. And then of course, you know, at Milwaukee and Iowa, we're gonna run the road course kit. So, I mean, the whole aero kit thing, I agree with Adam that there wasn't enough testing. I mean, talking to Ed Carpenter on Media Day, I mean, Carpenter said, you know, Chevy's been pretty transparent for sharing data, because being Penske is the only team that has a chance to test the oval kit. So,
yeah, you were talking about just either taking off the rear pods, which I think would upset the stability of the car, and I think also from a safety point they won't do. But they could always revert to the standard 2012 rear pods that Dallara used, which there seemed to be no issue with those. I think that could be an option that they do, where they let them keep the changes to the side pods ahead of the rear wheel, the rear wing, the front wing, and everything, and maybe just slap those Dallara rear pods on for the later oval races. It could be a good patchwork solution without having to completely abandon the concept altogether, which, when you think of abandoning the concept altogether, is just flushing money down a toilet and, you know, cheering about it. So,
yeah, I think the biggest thing that I have an issue with is, alright, here's your double-edged sword. If you're IndyCar and you've got this product and you want to release it to the world and you want to show it off and you want to make this beautiful grand entrance, the place you want to do it at is Indianapolis Motor Speedway in the Indy 500, because it is the biggest stage that you are seen on, by far and away the biggest stage. For a series that needs a little bit of help in areas, they don't need help here. That being said, I think you are at risk of losing more than you have to gain, because if you go out there with an absolute shit product that produces flips and this and that and the other, you know, ultimately you're putting something out there and everybody's seeing it, and it can turn a lot of people away. And that's the part that scares me, is because, yeah, you're putting it on the biggest stage, but I don't see the harm in testing. You know, even if you wanted to test here, back when it's a little colder, maybe, obviously, like, maybe there's not snow, pick a week. I mean, hell, everything around here, I mean, essentially the track is the series, and the series is the track, and you can kind of have a little bit more freedom to do what you want, to test when you want, to do it however you want. So I didn't see a problem from that point of view. But, you know, I think from that standpoint, you're at risk of more to lose. However, I really enjoyed, and I know, Adam, you read the piece, and Josh, I believe you read the piece. But Sebastian Bourdais had some great comments about the crashes that have happened here and about the overreaction, essentially, from the media, and essentially everybody outside of the sanctioning body and the drivers involved, and maybe that's putting pressure on the sanctioning body. But, you know, paraphrasing, you know, what we do is dangerous. Why the hell would anybody think what we do is safe? You know, we drive cars 220-plus miles an hour. Who in the hell would think this is safe? And, you know, he would go on to say that he's seen he's essentially seen different changes, rule changes, packages ruin racing in Europe when he was in F1. And when he says ruin racing, you know, when you're messing with a car, you can really play with the differences on how they perform on a certain racetrack, which could really ruin good racetracks. And that could really hurt the credibility of those tracks. And that could be a product here. He doesn't want to see it come over to IndyCar. You know, ultimately, we might be freaking out. He also went on to say that when he first came here to Indy, he saw five Chip Ganassi cars falling, you know, in practice. You know, we've seen five cars get in accidents the entire month of May. I think there's something to be said for that, and maybe the overreaction. Let's be honest here. It's scary when you see a driver get in the air, but I think everybody here knows that Elio landed softly. Ed Carpenter's crash was vicious. And according to everybody, Joseph Newgarden's car was due to a flat tire on why he caught air. Mm-hmm. So these things all being considered, we've seen really, really bad wrecks here. And what we've seen lately, minus Hinch's crash, has been relatively minimal in comparison.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, Hinch's crash was completely different from the other ones. And from the other ones, I mean, it was the suspension Parkdale that had 12,000 miles on it, and you know, I mean, thankfully he hit with a safer barrier pad. Thank God for that. But
yes.
But you know, it's I mean, but having a piece of suspension go through, which goes simply. I won't get into the gruesome details of that. But you know, and injuries like that have to be looked into. I mean, I would say, you know, I'm not an expert on suspension, but just from my perspective, you know, have suspension parts that crumple when they hit. I mean, obviously, you know, you want to build them as strong as possible, or else they're not gonna stand up to the G forces and the downforce flows. But you know, to make a long story short, it's just, you know, this month of May. I mean, we've kind of gotten used to the month of May being that have not been very accident-filled, but if you go to the daily track size report, you know, from the 90s or the 80s, you know, there was a lot more accidents and a lot more drivers were hurt in the sidelines of the month. You know?
I think that's something that, you know, Boy was definitely trying to bring home, was the importance of what this product has been evolutionized into, and that the outcry for seeing crashes like this, I mean, when you overreact, people are going to start thinking that what's happening is bigger than what it really was. And I think when you look at what it was back in the day, if the people nowadays, I mean, let's be honest, as we grow older, and you've got younger generations coming in, the older generations feel like the younger generations are getting spoiled. And, you know, don't get me wrong, all the safety innovations, drivers love to see the safety innovations, but there is a level of, I don't really necessarily have the word here, but there's, you don't want to sit here and make more out of it than it is. And I think that's part of where we're going. I mean, I've seen Dan Weldon flying a Panther car in turn two, you know, when Andretti was racing here early part of the decade. You know, there's crashes like that. That's a part of it. We've seen Mike Conway have that bad crash. I believe it was in four, was it, or three?
I can't remember.
But, you know, things like that have happened, and tomorrow's the race. We don't know how everything's going to play out. They were awfully racy on Fast Friday.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Carb day.
And, sorry, I keep getting... Sorry, folks. You know, and ultimately, I think Bourdais speaks the truth. You can't continue to overreact on this, because if you do, you're eventually going to just turn people away for good from the series, and that's not what's going to help any. That doesn't help anybody. You just have to accept the fact that what you do is dangerous. We as fans, as media, have to accept the fact that this is a dangerous sport, and ultimately shit happens. You know, take a line from Ghostbusters. You know, Bill Murray, what have you. There you go. That's summing it up in a nutshell. Anyway. Moving on. We got 15 minutes left here in the broadcast. I want to thank y'all for listening to us. Adam, we got three drivers per row. So this is how we're going to play this little game. And I won't reason three 20s, but I want you to give me a favorite, a sleeper, and a wild card. And ultimately...
Three trails?
No, just period. A sleeper,
a wild card,
favorite. And then ultimately give me your pick for who you think is going to be standing, putting the milk and having his face, his likeness, or her likeness, put on the Borg Warner Trophy.
All right. Well, not necessarily my favorite, but the favorite for the race is going to be Scott Dixon. I think the sleeper for the race, starting way back on the outside of row 5, is going to be Montoya. I think he will be there in the end. We're getting close to 200 laps. He will be there. I think the wild card, that's tough. But I think the wild card may very well be, and you'll love this because he's the second quickest Honda. I think the wild card might be Andretti. My overall pick to win, though, about a 50-50 between Power taking his first and Kanaan taking his second.
Wow. We haven't mentioned Kanaan this whole show, and he was third quickest in Carb Day.
Exactly. He's in the inside of row 2. And, you know, as we saw in 2013, he can get it done. And we know how much this race, this track, means to Tony Kanaan. And I think sometimes when you mention the Scott Dixons and the Will Powers and the Dario Franchitti and the Elio Castroneves of the world, Tony Kanaan almost sometimes gets left out when really he is the name that belongs right up there with those guys. And I think he has a really good chance of winning again tomorrow.
Yeah. For the overall pick to win, I would say Dixon. I would just say, you know, Dixon is, you know, for one thing, Dixon is constantly growing. I mean, he's never, even when he wins, he'll always look for a way to improve himself in a good way. You know, it's not that he's bitter or anything. For a sleeper, I would stand by my pick on Justin Wilson. I mean, and you know, if you want to go to a little bit of play the numerology game, Dan Weldon started in sixth place when he won his what would be his final Indy 500, and you know, I mean, he won it in purely surprising fashion, but he was in the top five the whole day. But you know, on Wilson, you know, Wilson knows where and when to pounce, and you know, if things start getting shaky up front and he's running in fourth place, you know, he's going to go for it. As long as he does it safely, you know. And for a wild card, I'm going to stand by who I wrote about yesterday. I'm going to stand by Ryan Briscoe, and the Vegas insider odds are 50-1 on this one. Yeah, everyone knows I love to gamble. But, you know, I think that, I mean, I think, the Briscoes come from behind before, and that team is riding, I want to say a whole wave of momentum, but you know, the car that Briscoe has 3 wins to his credit already. So, and the Schmidt cars have always been good at Indy. So and Briscoe is known a little bit more for his oval prowess and his road course prowess. So I'm just but then again, this is a wild card, so I'm gonna bet $20 on Briscoe and hope that 50-1 makes me rich. Have we lost the show now?
Maybe, quite possibly. If we had a show to begin with, we would have a show to lose. Oh boy, I don't know how to follow that up. You know what's funny about your pick with Justin Wilson is talk with him about the different things, because Ryan Hunter was the first Andretti Autosport guy to go out first, and Andretti, you know, and he essentially, you know, started this qualifying run, and it helped Justin figure out the gearing that he's supposed to have. The wind was right, but he's like, you know, man, I love the depth of this team, and that sounded more like Will Power, I guess. But now we've lost the ship. You know, you're looking at Justin Wilson, who because never Lehner go over there. Simona's in on the mix, and Carlos, I mean, that guy just badass constantly. So, you know, all things being considered, I think that that's not necessarily an unwise choice for tomorrow for Mr. Farmer. Now, onward to me. My picks. Oh, man. This whole field is stacked. How the hell do you guys pick anything?
How do we pick anything?
I have no idea. I'm kind of shocked that we picked Pagano, because Pagano has been awful quick, and ironically, he's been steadily the top two as far as speed goes for Penske the entire month thus far. I'm actually kind of stunned that one of y'all didn't pick him. I'm sure Frank would have, or somebody. I would disagree. But, for the favorite, I hate saying this. He won the 2008 race from pole. I mean, Scott Dixon has got to be considered the favorite because he is just cerebral. He doesn't let emotion get in that race car. He's just cold, calculated, and just attacks. And he doesn't even care if he wins turn one to lead. He's willing to say, hey, yeah, go ahead, Lamar, do whatever you want. I'm just going to hang out casually behind you and wait till the end and stalk you. So, I'd have to say Scott Dixon's the favorite. I say that uneasily because when he starts on a pole, usually he generally kicks everybody's ass. I don't think there's any way in hell Elio's touching his fourth. My sleeper for this race, it's got to be Carlos Munoz. I look at him, and he's improved. He's just steadily up there. I mean, he's got second, he's got fourth, maybe this year he finishes sixth, or maybe this is the year that he gets a chance to go do it. 15 years after Juan Pablo Montoya won it, another Colombian standing in victory lane. I very much could see it. I know he would love that. Talking to me, he said that's achieving all of his career goals right there. I don't know if championships on the list, but I know Indy 500 damn sure is. For the wild card, Juan Pablo Montoya has to be it. I mean, he's in row five. He's just as chilled as I'll get out. And he knows this race. He knows this car. He knows how to just manage everything. Tires. I don't expect Oriol Servia or Charlie Kimball or J.R. Hildebrand or Ed Carpenter to be able to manage their equipment quite like he does and then do it for as long as he can for 500 miles. I want to see a good run for Ryan Briscoe. I really would. I'd love to see a good run for Takuma Sato. Everybody knows who I hope wins this thing. But besides that point, by the way, did you know Marco Andretti's turtle won? It's supposed to be a good omen that the winner gets the 500, but he pointed out to me that his turtle's won like three times. So
Andretti lost.
He said TK pointed it out to him. He didn't realize it until TK told him something about that.
Huh.
Oh, man. All right. Drum roll, please. No? Okay. I guess without further ado, I'll tell you that my winner, my pick for this race, is going to be... Awkward silence.
You take so long, my gosh.
Well, I got to make it suspenseful. Takuma Sato. Going to deliver it for AJ Foyt.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, I mean, 99, AJ Foyt, what he did, the way he feels about his car. I mean, he starts in row 8 on the outside. That's a tall task. But, I mean, I'm not going to pick who I hope. I can't pick who I hope because I can't do that to my driver at this point. But, I tell you what, Jonathan Bell could run really well here. He was running great last year, and he's always running well here. But I didn't realize he only had three top credits. So, that being said, those are our fun picks for tomorrow. It's going to be a wild race. I want to say... it's going to be there's a possibility. I know Hinch is going to be watching, whether if somehow he manages to get out here, which is speculated, or if he's watching it from the hotel and Kirsten's taking care of him. But other than that, I want to also give remembrance to Jules Bianchi, who's still fighting, you know, Forza Jules. He scored points at this time last year during the Monaco weekend. And, you know, it was the first points for him, it was the first points for Marussia, now Manor Marussia. And he ended up finishing eighth, got penalized, took home a ninth. But ultimately, it was points for that team. I don't want to forget that for the Frenchman, the incredibly young talent that he was. As well as get well soon, Hinch, and keep fighting, Michael. I know I speak on behalf of Adam, Josh, myself, and also Frank Santorowski that joined us earlier. And without further ado, I want to thank y'all for listening. And before we go, Adam, throw us your final thoughts and let the world know who you are as far as the Twitter handle goes.
Final thoughts. Well, Twitter is at Adam L. Tate. I'm not in Indianapolis with these wonderful gentlemen, so my main focus of the weekend is the Monaco Grand Prix. Hamilton is on pole. Ross Burton and Vettel are behind it, as usual, but Monaco is always unpredictable. So I'll be bringing you coverage of that, and then jumping on and watching the 500 and hearing a lot of great stories from you guys.
Yeah, my final thought is, well, this is my second Indy 500, and I'm looking forward to it as always, and just hopeful for a safe race, and hoping that the drivers take care of each other given what they have.
Absolutely incredible, and I look forward to tomorrow's race. Hope for a positive outcome. I definitely hope for the safety of the drivers and the teams, given some of the stuff that's happened lately. And, you know, looking forward to Monaco, looking forward to Indy, to Coke 600. To me, it's the best weekend of the year. And ultimately, I'm just excited to experience this, because this is definitely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that I hope to have more than once. Adam, your ass is going to be up here with us next year.
Yes, it will.
You know, it's just been an absolute treat. And can't thank IndyCar enough for letting Tribute Racing come up here and let that be possible. And lastly, Twitter handles. You've got, Josh, did you say your Twitter handle?
Oh,
you forgot.
No, I forgot. My Twitter handle is jfarmer77.
Good job.
Thank you.
No problem. Yeah, the Tribute Racing Twitter handle is at Tribute Racing. And my Twitter handle, the annoying voice talking on the microphone right now, if you're listening out there, is at JoeyBarnes85. So, once again, this was Adam Tate, Josh Farmer, Joey Barnes, all of Tribute Racing. It's been a pleasure to have you all as our listeners, and we can't wait to bring you more next week. So, that being said, wish you a good night. Can't wait for you to turn on your TVs at 11 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow and check out this Indy 500. It's definitely going to be a great one, folks. Have a good night.